Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080110, American General Finance, Inc. versus Kyle Allen from Bexar County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 080444, Myred Properties, Inc. versus LaSalle Bank National Association from Bell County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. And docket number 080836, In Re Weekly Homes, LP, which is here in an original proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each argument, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to all three arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080110, American General Finance, Inc. versus Kyle Allen.
May it please the court, Mr. Danish will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. Multiple issues have been presented in our briefing, but there seem to be two most important issues. The first, whether the disbursement services incidental to a home equity loan sought to avoid a tax lien foreclosure or services under the DTPA, the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act, and secondly, whether a lender can be assessed usurious penalties or usury penalties for a charge that was never received by the plaintiff. We believe the answer to the first question is no, it is not a Deceptive Trade Practice Act or within the Act, and the standard applied by the Court of Appeals is excessively broad and conflicts with those of other courts.
Let me ask you, in terms of framing the question, you define what the bank did as disbursement services. But wasn't it, at least isn't there a fact issue on whether it was something more, taking care of the lawsuit? I mean, resolving a lawsuit is more than mere disbursement of loan proceeds. And don't we have a fact issue as to whether the bank undertook that obligation?
May I address that this way? In the context of what was before the summary judgment court, the only portion of their response that related to our contention that this individual is not a consumer had to do with escrow services and had nothing to do with the objective of the borrower. And the testimony, there was no testimony offered in that with respect to that particular point, but what was cited in other points was quite exceedingly thin.
But, I mean, there was some testimony and I understand it was controverted, but there was some testimony that the bank undertook to resolve the suit.
Well, if I might point out to the court, the summary judgment court was presented as part of the misrepresentation allegation and not as part of the consumer argument, testimony from the plaintiff, where he said, I was asking, you know, for a loan to help me out with a tax suit. Now, they said they would take care of it being the taxes. Our position, and I might add that we're not a bank, we're a finance company my client does not provide deposit services. It does not provide independent escrow services. It simply loans money. And in this case, it made a home equity loan, a non-recourse loan. So their only remedy in the event of default was the property itself. But to get back to my point, the summary judgment court only had testimony that I want a loan to pay for my taxes, and the statement that they would take care of the taxes, which is incidental or ancillary to the services that they provided. It was not a fee that was charged for. There was no disbursement fee charged. It was primarily done to benefit the lender, which is basically, and it was done to establish the superiority of their lien position a la other or versus other lien holders.
And they did this service for others, not just in this case, but I mean, it was kind of a routine part of the
correct the business. Yeah. Testimony, not before the summary judgment court, but at the trial court, was that these are routine and ancillary and incidental to the loan transaction itself.
In answering this question about consumer status, are you saying that we cannot look at anything that was in the case that was tried to the jury, that we have to only look at the summary judgment evidence as presented to the judge?
Well, of course, it's hard not to look at anything else because we have a full and complete record. But in the context of reversing the summary judgment, and in the context of did the summary judgment court correctly rule at the time, I think the court must look back at what was in the record at that particular time and what was presented. For example, in the reply to this.
The question is,
pardon me?
Is that the only thing we look at? If trial judge grants summary judgment, and nobody moves to set that aside at trial, or that's not set aside at trial, the only thing we could look at is the summary judgment record, right?
Well, I would think so. And I might add that the trial court, the judge that tried this case, Judge Payden, was different from the judge who heard the summary judgment evidence. Judge Bircherman is the judge who granted the summary judgment, the partial summary judgment.
That's always the case in San Antonio.
Well, and it can be the case and is often the case in San Antonio because of the revolving docket. I'm suggesting to the court,
what was the testimony? Why doesn't your client, if you're getting a loan to pay off, they knew this loan was to pay off the taxes, at least part of it. Why didn't they pay off all of them?
They made a mistake. The file included the correct amount, which is approximately $6,300. The due diligence they did to correctly determine the correct amount was actually done. They simply, for whatever reason, typed an incorrect amount on the settlement statement and underfunded the payment of the taxes.
And sent it to the wrong place. I mean, it was 6 weeks after the loan closed that check arrived.
They did not. I don't think they sent it to the wrong place. What they did is there's a gap between when they cut the check and when the taxing authority actually processed it. And there was really no explanation that I can recall about that delay. Either it was either on our side of the case or on the taxing authority side of the case. But to answer your question, they made a mistake. And I guess that is part of the crux of this. They made a mistake. It was not an intentional mistake. And there, as much as I've thought about this case, they had nothing to gain and everything to lose by their mistake. Number one, they lost their security interest, and with a non-recourse note, that's all they have. Number two, they exposed themselves to a suit, which they did. There was nothing driving their decision or their inadvertent mistake that would somehow benefit them. There was no deception that would somehow benefit them. This was a simple mistake.
But, of course, under the DTPA, it doesn't. It also covers mistakes.
It does.
And so why shouldn't, you know, if you make this mistake and somebody loses their house, even though he wasn't living in the house? Nope. Was anybody living in the house?
Under the record, he was not living in the house, had never lived in the house when it was deeded to him, since it was deeded to him in 1994, and supposedly his brothers were living in the house. Also under the record, he never made a single payment.
Right.
And never got property insurance.
But let's assume a better case that, it was somebody's home, and they lose their home because this is not paid off. Why shouldn't that be a deceptive trade practice?
Well, they have a remedy, first of all, in contract, number one, which would provide them.
Of course, the DTPA is in addition to other remedies in contract.
Yeah. I think it shouldn't be because the this was in its essence simply a loan. It's not unlike Riverside in the sense that this gentleman had didn't want his car to be repossessed. It's not unlike Fix. It's not unlike Munn, where they simply wanted money.
But if it were just a loan, he would get his check for $15,000 or whatever it was and then pay the taxes himself. But it seems like at least there's some evidence that he, the primary or the main objective of this, he didn't seek the loan before he got notice that there was a tax lawsuit. So the primary reason for coming down and getting AGF's advice was to get the taxes paid, right?
Well, I would beg to differ. I think the primary driving force was to get money, and the money, how you use the money, and that's one of our observations. You, in this day of commerce, there's almost no loan that isn't accompanied by some service, and particularly a mortgage loan or a home equity loan. There is always going to be a service that is incidental or ancillary to the loan. And, of course, that is our position, that the standard that we believe should apply is, first, is there an existing debt or obligation that needs to be discharged, a la Riverside and others, or are these services incidental or ancillary to the loan itself? You can come up with almost any reason why a loan, some objective, there is some objective to a loan other than simply getting the money. If you take that road, almost any statement, almost any service that's provided incidental to a loan is going to be subject to the Trade Practice Act. And I don't think, in my humble opinion, I don't think that's what the Act was intended for.
Counsel, I hear your argument. Knight and Flanagan, however, pretty broad. In Flanagan, for example, the bank was the S&E of the note, not even involved in the initial transaction. What do you do with those two cases?
Well, they were actually for the purchase of goods. I mean, in Knight, the gentleman was buying a dump truck. And in Knight, there was a retail installment contract that had a prohibited waiver clause in it, as I understand it.
I thought you were pretty convincingly telling us not to pay much attention to the purpose of the loan because, well, there's always a purpose and the bank or the lender may or may not know about
maybe
it.
Maybe I didn't make myself clear because what we're talking about here is a service. What was, we were talking about and what the court was talking about in Flanagan and in Knight was a good. I mean, they were actually buying a house. He was actually buying a dump truck, and the definition of services in the Act itself is a little bit broader. I mean, I'll recall you back to the statement of the Fifth Circuit in Munn, and I know that that's not necessarily controlling to this court, but that court pointed out that the definition of services includes those rendered in connection with the purchase or sale or repair of goods. There was no such expanded definition in connection with services rendered in connection with the sale or purchase of loans or intangibles.
But LaSara Grain says services includes an activity. LaSara Grain,
yes.
Service includes an activity on behalf of one party by another, and that seemed to be a pretty broad and different definition than Munn.
Well, it is broad, but again, this court has not looked at this issue of services in connection with DTPA, as best I can tell, in 20 years. I think in the context of this particular case, the fact that this was an incidental disbursement service that was primarily aimed at protecting the superiority of the lien of the lender, that is a legitimate distinction between these other cases. Again,
is there anything to distinguish this disbursement from any other disbursement of loan proceeds in a home mortgage context or anything where there's some allocation of proceeds as a result of the closing?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, if you look at the settlement statement, the HUD settlement statement, you'll find that it lists the amount for the taxes. It lists an amount for some credit insurance. There's the list an amount for an appraisal. And they simply underpaid one of the funding, one of the items. There will always be, and I speak generally, but there will always be those services that a company alone. This is not an escrow agent. They do not provide this service independent. If Mr. Allen had come in and said, I want you to handle the disbursement of funds for me, they would say, we cannot do it. We don't do that. That's not our business. Our business is to loan money. They don't take accounts. They don't take deposits. They simply loan money. It was in the charge for the fee. In a broader perspective, I think what this does, what it can do, is it could make every home equity loan, every refinance loan, every mortgage loan that is accompanied by some service, which they all are, subject to the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. It's a very, very broad application of the rule that, given the way services were defined, I don't think was the intent.
What are some examples of services that AGF could have provided that, in your opinion, would have made Allen the consumer in this case? I mean, you're focusing on your case. We've got to draw a line with this opinion between yes and no. There's some companies that want to provide services. You're saying your company, AGF, doesn't provide services.
Well, for example,
but what are some that do?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think there might be some lenders that charge separate line item fees for certain services. I can't tell you precisely what they are, but in our case, in my client's case, the testimony, and I know we're talking about a summary judgment here, but in terms of context for the court, the testimony was we do not provide escrow services or deposit services. For example, I suppose there are cases where a checking account agreement and the failure to honor certain checks was found to be covered within the act. That was the case in which, you know, that was a specific service for which they charged a fee.
Yes, sir.
So,
are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Danish.
Thank you, Judge.
Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Crofts will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, let me begin by disagreeing with counsel's response to Justice O'Neill's initial question and to Justice Heck's recent question. Summary judgment evidence presented by both sides included the deposition of Kyle Allen, my client, the plaintiff, and in that deposition, he said, I went to this finance company not just to get a loan and have some disbursements made. I went to this finance company asking for help with this tax suit. And, of course, he took those tax suit papers, and the whole reason for initiating the transaction was the tax suit papers with which he brought in to this loan officer.
But to be clear on that, I suppose he wasn't asking them to negotiate a settlement or anything like that. He just wanted whatever they wanted paid. Is that true?
Well, that's true, but it also involved, and this is in the deposition testimony as well, finding out who they were owed to, where to take the money, what to do in order to do that.
But they were just, AGF was just supposed to pay off whatever the amount was.
Well, that would not have disposed of the tax suit, and the deposition testimony is I wanted help with this tax suit, and the officer said we'll help you with this tax suit by doing these things.
Well, that's what I'm unclear about, is whether those things involve anything other than finding out what the demand was and paying it. Surely AGF was not going to negotiate them down or okay, the bill's $6,500, will you take $6,300 or something like that?
That record doesn't reveal one way or the other about that, but it did, taking care of the tax suit would involve obtaining a release, adjudication document that would dispose of the tax suit. That's what the problem was. I think picking up...
He would have known they weren't lawyers. He didn't hire them to be his lawyer.
That's correct. That's correct. But he said, I want help with this tax suit, and the bank officer said, this is what we do. We can do it. I'll do it. This is in the trial testimony. I'll take the papers over to the lawyer for these taxing agencies who, according to our system, I'm supposed to deal with.
But isn't that the only way they could protect their lien, if they actually got the tax taken care of? Because it seems like with a non-recourse loan.
Well, that would have been something that they would have wanted to do, and their testimony is we would have wanted to do it for that purpose.
Well, actually, most lenders are going to say, we are going to do it because that's the only way we're protected in this case.
That was not the nature of the transaction that was related to Mr. Allen when he went in. And there's a case on this by the Third Court, Judge Shannon, I think it's cited in the opinion, called Fortner versus Fannin Bank. And it involved a loan with respect to a car. And the borrower brought a DTPA case against this bank because the representation was, we'll get this title registered for you. And they didn't. And because he didn't get it registered for him, a prior materialman's lien got to be prior and resulted in loss of the car. The bank said, oh, well, we would record the certificate in the ordinary course of our business because that's what we do. Well, that's how we protect our lien. Court of Appeals said, that's well and fine, but antecedent to that was this transaction with the borrower in which he could have taken the tax title to go get recorded. That's what a car owner is supposed to do. But you said that you would do it for him. And your failure to do that resulted in this prior lien. And according to this opinion, the fact that it has an ancillary purpose.
Whose opinion was that?
I think Judge Shannon wrote the opinion for the Third Court of Appeals.
Well, I'm just in the abstract. This is not like a bait and switch or a fake going out of business sale. We don't have to worry about other banks trying to do this because no bank in their right mind would do this. You're going to lose money every time. You lose your lien. I mean, there's no motive or incentive for any bank to do what happened here. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I think I would agree with that.
So, again, the abstract and, of course, deceptive trade practice name covers things that one might not necessarily think of as deceptive or trade, but this wouldn't be either, just in the abstract.
Well, I think it would be. Our claim is that there was a misrepresentation. Various misrepresentations under some laundry list in the DTPA about the quality of the service that was going to be provided by this finance company. And I think it's very important. We're only dealing with the one question of the consumer qualification. What is the status for the consumer qualification?
And they say, well, this is, all loans. And you would agree, I assume, virtually every loan is obtained to buy something.
Well,
in other words, people don't borrow.
I would say.
Almost, because people don't borrow at 5 or 8 or whatever percent interest at home equity loans are now, 8 or 10, so they can put it in a CD and get 3%, or put it in the stock market and lose all their money. I mean, they
might put it under their mattress.
They borrow money from the bank to buy stuff almost always. And so how do we distinguish this case? If this case is a consumer, wouldn't all loans end up being consumer
transactions? No, sir. There's another case, and this was mentioned by the other side. I think one of the most important cases, discussions of this subject, was in this FDIC versus Munn. It was a Fifth Circuit case by Judge Higginbotham, and it dealt with a transaction at a bank a little bit complicated. Mr. Munn wanted to buy some stock from a corporation, and in order for them to be able to, other shareholders to sell that corporation, they had to get this loan. And in the settlement, loan transaction, all kind of in a ball of wax, Mr. Munn signed this guarantee to the bank, and the bank, the company that he bought the stock in folded pretty much immediately, and he brought this action against the bank. Well, Judge Higginbotham, in saying, he really analyzed this court's decisions in the Riverside and Flinikin and Knight and LaSera, and said, here are the competing concepts we have. One, an extension of credit, loan of money in and of itself, that's not a good or service, even though the court reserved in that case. What about the issue of other services that go along with that's what we're here for. And he dealt with this question. Everything involves a service. Every transaction has some kind of service. So if you can go in and complain about something in the context of a lending transaction that's just an ordinary service like processing costs or recording fees, that would undermine the court's holding in Lewis that, you know, that kind of thing just isn't going to be a good or a service. On the other hand, he said, and he cited a Court of Appeals case, Rittenhour, which involved a unique set of facts in which a customer went down to the bank and said, I want you to put a hold on this account dealing with the loan transaction. And they said, we will, but then they didn't. And in that case, the Court of Appeals said, well, that's different from a loan. That's more than just a loan. They said, we're going to do this extra thing for you that's not in the ordinary course of a loan. And they did it. And so the Court of Appeals in that case, I believe it was Corpus Christi, said that's actionable. Judge Higginbotham in the FDIC case said that represents a middle ground, where there is a service that's not merely incidental to the loan, not merely a disbursement, where the DTPA ought to provide some protection because it's something other than an incidental aspect of a loan of money. And he said it's not always easy to determine what that is. And he said we need some help, and that's one of the refinements this case can result in as the court resolves it. How do you tell the difference? In that case, Judge Higginbotham said, this is a case in which the lender assumed unique duties.
So how do we tell the difference here? How do we tell the difference here?
Well, the difference here is a service of taking part of the loan proceeds, which at that point, you know, was borrowed by my client, Mr. Allen, and belonged to him, taking those loan proceeds to wherever it needed to go, and that's what the deposition testimony is, wherever it needed to go and to whoever it needed to go to take care of a suit that's pending against me. Now, that's not, and I don't think you can say that as a matter of law, that's not an independent, unique duty that was assumed by this lender. Another Court of Appeals case trying to make this distinction that's cited in the briefs, and that's the
Before you move from the Fifth Circuit case, Justice Judge Higginbotham says in his opinion, discussing Rittenhour, the Rittenhour established that the bank's financial counseling and the hold on his account were central to the transaction by showing that he considered them important enough to seek them separately from the purchase of the CD. Were there separate services contracted for in this?
It was all one transaction, Judge. And that does distinguish Rittenhour from our case. It doesn't distinguish it in Judge Higginbotham's view from the facts in the Munn case, because it was all at the same time.
Was there any financial counseling in this case?
Well, the trial testimony reveals that reveals.
And the summary judgment record.
The summary judgment record is I went in there with my tax papers and I asked for them, could they help me take care of this tax suit? And they said, yes, we can help you take care of that tax suit by this loan. And that's, now, I think it's important here to note that the only ground for summary judgment urged is one global sentence, and that is, and this is the only DQPA ground before the court that's in their motion, and that is, a loan is not a good or a service. Number two, incidental aspects of a loan are not actionable under the DQPA. That's all their motion says.
Okay, I'm just trying to get a better understanding of this. You said that it's not an independent, unique duty, and that is the paying of this land or resolving this lawsuit. Is that what you're...
Well, I'm saying I don't know that that label has to be satisfied in every case. That was the way that Judge Higginbotham made the distinction in his case. The Court of Appeals case, McGinn, which cites another Court of Appeals case holding that financial counseling was an independent service that made the borrower a DQPA consumer. They characterize the test as, does it involve something that's not typical in a borrowing context?
Let's talk about this specific transaction here. Is this typical? As I understood, counsel on the other side, he said, this is not typical.
If it's not typical, then it's an independent service. If it's not typical, that's a representation they made that's not an incidental aspect of a loan, and that makes our case.
One thing that the court has to be concerned about, I think, is, you know, in this climate particularly, there are refinancings going on all over the place in which escrow accounts are set up and property taxes are to be paid from those accounts, and I can just imagine that there will be, you know, mistakes made along the way with the frenzy that is occurring here and trying to get ahead of whatever deadline is going to come with, you know, whatever happens with the new administration. Are you saying that in those cases, if property taxes are not paid, if the escrow account is not satisfied according to the terms, that there might be a DTPA suit in those instances?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because I think in many of those transactions, a mere taking care of taxes is, and I think it can be a, it, I don't know that there can be a hard and fixed rule about disbursement and taxes, because I think in some transactions they're just as routine and incidental as they can be. On the other extreme of in the same climate, what about the credit card companies that send us things in the mail daily practically and say, sign up with us, we'll loan you this money, we'll take this money, and we'll discharge your other credit card debts at a lower rate, and I sign up and rely on that, and lo and behold, they don't do that, and because they don't do that, a check bounces, and I get a lien against me. I think that's a case in which there is an independent primary objective that's not merely ancillary to the loan. That credit card company agreed to deal with a third party that I have a connection with to protect my interest, and they didn't do it.
Let me ask you, kind of tangential to that, but on the subject of mitigation. I understand your argument that if they had paid off the taxes, he wouldn't have lost the house. But it also seems like he wouldn't have lost the house if he'd opened his mail. And why isn't that a matter of mitigation?
Well, that was, in terms of their complaint, is that there should have been a mitigation instruction given to not award damage, and the instruction tendered, which would go with the typical damage question, was don't award any money, don't award any damage for any injury that resulted from, it didn't fit with any question that was given. And it wouldn't fit with a question asking, did the failure to pay those taxes result in the foreclosure? It didn't fit. Now, they advanced that in the negligence context, and the jury found that, and this fits with their officer's testimony. I mean, this record is replete with this officer's testimony to the effect that it was my failure that resulted in this tax foreclosure, and it didn't have anything to do with what Mr. Allen did or didn't do. Nevertheless, that got into the case in the comparative negligence question, which the jury answered in favor of.
We didn't give Mr. Danish a chance to go into usury at all, but do you have anything to say about that?
Yes, sir. I do think that there's room for some refinement on that subject. We only have this court's case in the Fuller case, decision in the Fuller case, which says you can't just have a book entry. It's got to be communicated, even if it's communicated indirectly. I think that their position is not one that should be adopted, which is that it needs to be read and understood, because that's a slippery slope, I think, in any usury case, because we'll have, you know, what did you understand about this? Did you understand it well enough? Do you know enough to understand? I think because usury is a penalty, and because it's the cases say it's on the legislative books to guard against abusive lenders, that the test ought to be if the usurious charge goes out the door into a channel, public channel destined to intended to reach that borrower, that is a charge. I think that's the only way.
But if somebody's not taking or returning calls from their bank and they're not paying back the loan, can that person who's not paying a dime of the loan and refusing to talk with their bank then say, but something you sent me that I never read either was usurious? That seems a little unfair. It seems like you're having your cake and eating it too.
Well,
if my unopened mail, I get the benefit of it because I'm not going to pay you or talk to you about paying. But if there's something in there that you made a mistake on, you're going to have to penalized for it.
My response to that, Judge, is I see what you're saying, but a usury penalty, fairness and penalty statutes isn't what they're about. And number one, I think those facts are a little extreme. They knew where Mr. Allen was in Oregon. And he wasn't there where the mail arrived, but he intended to pay that loan. He sent the money to his brothers. The brother lied to him about, you know, not paying it to the lender. And so Mr. Allen wasn't there, but he doesn't have the badge of.
But if it had picked up the phone and talked to the bank, he'd have found out what his brother was doing.
That's. I don't know that you can interpret the usury statute on nuances like that.
Well, we're trying to decide what charge means, and it just
right. And you're all. I think you're all. Would you want to have litigation about this kind of fact in every usury case? And that's what I think. Needs to be avoided by having a rule that if you're a lender and you send it out, that's a charge.
Further questions?
I have a quick question. I'm having trouble understanding the dynamic here, because procedurally, if we were to agree with the Court of Appeals, then what happens? Mr. Allen's elected to recover in contract. I mean, is this case really going to be retried?
I think the directive from the Court of Appeals is to give Mr. Allen a chance to see if he can get the DTPA finding, and if
which would require a retrial.
At least on that question, yes. And then if he failed to get it, and my understanding from their decision is that the rest of the decision would spring into place for what the adjudication ought to be.
Really? Because I've never thought you could just go retry one little claim. I thought you had to. Send the whole thing back, no?
I don't think there's a black or white rule on that. I know that you can't have to try the whole case if it's in the default context and when its liability is contested.
Well, you'd have to retry the question of whether he would, whether they had an agreement that AGF would pay the taxes.
If the jury
in the second trial said no, then we couldn't spring back into the jury answer that said yes.
I would think that's what the Court of Appeals intended. Let me mention that one last thing that Judge Higginbotham in that Munn case did decide. There's a jury question on this consumer thing. There's evidence that makes it independent, that makes it an objective that's not simply an incidental aspect of a loan.
Oh, yeah.
But there's evidence on the other side.
I'm just not understanding the dynamic.
Thank you.
I'm having a hard time. Can you help me with the dynamic? I can't believe he appeals up here on a $2,000 usury penalty.
I would like to help you with a dynamic, as I've thought about it.
You don't have to answer it. I don't want to put you on the spot.
Well, I'm not sure that I would say please put this in the bank, if you will, but my impression is we go back and try the DTPA piece of this case. But I don't know how you go back and not start over.
That's my question.
Were other pieces of the case that we have not talked about, but as a follow-up regarding the conduct that...
You view the remand then as only as to the DTPA claim, and no error has been assigned to that, or do you read the remand differently?
Well, it looks like it's a remand only on the DTPA piece, but I don't know how you do that, frankly.
Plus, we've just never seen that in terms of election of remedies, you know, when they're kind of bifurcated like this. There's summary judgment early on and then a trial and then send it back down to try the other part that the plaintiff could elect. It just is odd.
It is, and I would invite the court to please consider some of the evidence that was excluded, because as a follow-up to one of the questions about not only not paying anybody, not telling us their brothers were going to pay the money, not following up with the brothers, not taking 30 calls. There was also an affidavit we think was clearly false that was filed to spring the proceeds out of the court we were never informed about. In fact, my client did not find out that the property had actually been foreclosed upon until they filed their judicial foreclosure suit and learned in a counterclaim that the property had actually been foreclosed upon 4 months earlier. So if we do go back to try it, we felt the court should have allowed that, what we contend is a false affidavit, into the record, because it clearly goes to, in our view, issues of good faith, credibility, whether or not he ever had any intent at all to repay this loan. On the usury piece, I would simply say that I agree with counsel in that I think we need some guidance on this, but I think the guiding principle is that this is a punitive and penal in nature and should therefore be strictly construed. And in this case, there's no dispute that he may have received it at an address, although one of the letters was returned unclaimed, but he never read it.
Question is whether it was charged, and so whether you have to know about it to know whether for it to have been charged. And here's my question: what if he had received and read the letter, but under the finance code, the bank had sent a correction notice that he had not read? Then, under your urging, the correction letter would not be good either.
There's a specific curing provision in the statute. I don't think the statute speaks to what is proper delivery of the usurious charge.
But you would divorce those two, and you'd say you've got to read it for it to be usury. But if you read it, and therefore you're charged, but you don't read the correction, bank gets the benefit of the correction.
I'm not sure once you read it, you can correct it.
Oh, okay. I'm talking about the bank correcting it up.
Anyway. May I speak just briefly about Munn, particularly in the context of the summary judgment evidence? I again would invite the court to look back at the response. The response specifically addressed the Allen's lack of consumer status, the objective issue that has been replete throughout this argument and the briefing, was not ever presented to the summary judgment court. The only thing they cited in the response was that somehow or another we were providing escrow services, and citing the court to the Zimmerman and commercial escrow company cases. There's no mention whatsoever about objective. The language or the evidence about intent came in about a 20-line section of deposition. It was cited under misrepresentation under a response to our claim that there was no evidence of misrepresentation. So this summary judgment court was never given evidence about objective in the context of one being a consumer, and I invite the court to look back at that. And then just quickly say that the Munn court, and I know I'm about out of time, made a distinction between the statutory language referencing services furnished in connection with the sale of a good and the absence of that language, services in connection with the sale of other services. And quoting, under they were again discussing the fact that almost all transactions, commercial transactions, consumer transactions, and company services. Under this approach, any service involved in a stock purchase or a loan transaction would give rise to a DTPA consumer status, even though the loan could not thereby undermining the legislature's exclusion of sales. This is a timely issue because of what we may have ahead of us. And I appreciate the court's time. I assume I'm finished.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.